The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from the News and Observer. Now, before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Taking a weekend trip is certainly one way to satisfy your thirst for travel. Well, today on Armchair Traveler, writer Catherine Streeter explains how West Virginia rewards weekend visitors. Originally written as a special to the Washington Post, her article was also published in the March 13, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. Let's see what she's learned. We are lifelong, happy urbanites, but beltway tensions coupled with the Omicron wave and a long, cold winter left me and my husband yearning to disappear over the weekend to change the scenery and catch our breaths. Cozy fireplaces, quiet walks in the woods, good food and historic streets were what we had in mind. A long drive was not. We quickly homed in on West Virginia as the perfect destination. Over the border, an eastern panhandle trio of quaint towns, Charlestown, Harper's Ferry, and Shepherdstown, provided the soulful retreat we needed. We got on the road from Washington, D.C., late morning on a Friday at the end of February, and just over an hour later pulled into Charlestown, West Virginia. Hungry, we made our way to Sumitra Thai Kitchen and Bar on West Washington Street, the main drag of town, the county seat of Jefferson County. We ordered bubble tea and the shrimp and avocado roll appetizer before devouring red chicken curry and stir fry. As lovers of fresh Thai flavors, we found this little restaurant to be a real gem. During the afternoon, we explored the town founded by Charles Washington, George Washington's brother. Strolling through the historic district, worked off our lunch, and we paused at the formidable Jefferson County Courthouse. Our on-the-spot research revealed that the fiery abolitionist John Brown stood trial here in 1859. Curious, we discovered Brown was executed in a field a few blocks away, a site now marked by a historical plaque. Using Google Maps, we followed walking directions to Zion Episcopal Church Cemetery, where 70-plus members of the Washington family are buried, more than in any other place in the country. We caught a much-needed caffeine boost at the popular Sibling Coffee Roasters, where locals were hanging out and the barista was greeting customers by name, then stopped at Abolitionist Ale Works to pick up a 4-pack of brew, including the IPA Haze of the New, to take home. The 15-minute drive to Hillbrook Inn is along curvy, picturesque country roads. A snaking driveway leads to the sprawling inn, the 1920s home of Brigadier General Frank E. Bamford. After checking in, we were led through a maze of rooms and up a couple of short flights of narrow stairs to our room, the Grand Bamford Suite. To accommodate our preferred weekend dates, the inn had invited us to spend our second night in the snuggery because it would show us two different setups. For now, we found ourselves in an expansive suite decked out with sofas, a full vanity set, and regal four-poster bed, with a separate entrance where we could park. We caught up on reading and emails in the cozy setting area, facing the fireplace, before changing for dinner. Along with other guests, we enjoyed pre-dinner drinks in the intimate low-lit bar with a fireplace. In the dining room, sommelier Marine Kahn recommended 2017 Clos de Poitiers Saint-Georges, a storied Nun Saint-Georges Premier Cru wine from Burgundy. We chatted about her French background, her training in Bordeaux, and her family. She comes from a line of chefs, sommeliers, and butchers at home where food and wine are sacred, she said. After a starter of a half dozen oysters, our entrees of monkfish and venison arrived, rounding out an altogether satisfying evening. Chef Jean Van Holt, who joined the inn 6 months ago, told me he aims to make the restaurant a major culinary destination and garner a Michelin star, a reasonable goal given his international experience working in 3-star Michelin restaurants. In Harper's Ferry the following morning, we met Park Ranger Isaac Wickensizer of the National Park Service for a private tour. He started us at the beginning, taking us to the point, the area overlooking the confluence of the Potomac and Shenandoah Rivers. He explained that Harpers Ferry exists because President George Washington elected the strategic site for a federal armory, spurring the economy and birthing a bustling town. Wickenheiser talked and walked with us around Lower Town, the restored 19th century historic district, and described highlights from the town's history, which include the John Brown Raid, a precursor to the Civil War, in which he seized the armory in a failed attempt to foment an uprising of enslaved people and like-minded abolitionists. The event emboldened Northern and anti-slavery sentiment. To get some exercise, we decided to hike to the overlooked cliff above Harpers Ferry using the Maryland Heights Trail. We followed the pedestrian bridge over the Potomac River, a footbridge that is part of the Appalachian Trail. Fun fact, the faded sign on the mountain face seen from the bridge is from an early 1900s advertisement, Menon's Berated Talcum Toilet Powder. At the bottom of the bridge, we walked north a short distance on the C&O Canal towpath until signs to the trailhead rather appeared. The hike is marked well and leads to the scenic overlook, about a four-mile hike total. When we arrived at the overlook, it started snowing. We joined a hushed group of more than 20 hikers admiring the view amid swirling snowflakes. Back in town on the highly trafficked High Street, I poked my head into a few shops. At True Treats Historic Candy, spokeswoman Mary Ann Fisher said the store is the only research-based historic candy shop in the country. Supplying museums around the country, it's chock full of treats from the first candy ever through the 1900s. And I watched parents anxiously monitoring children who, with shining eyes, were grabbing handfuls of candy to plop into their wicker shopping baskets. Back in our car after a quick walk to Jefferson Rock to see the view, Thomas Jefferson praised extravagantly in 1785. We stopped for a quick bite at a place that bills itself as the state's first vegan restaurant, Kelly Farm Kitchen, whose building resembles a dollhouse, only to learn that it suspended indoor seating during the pandemic. Given the cold weather, we took a rain check. We rolled into Shepherdstown, the oldest town in West Virginia, dating to about the 1730s, and parked along German Street in the downtown historic district, a street that looks like a painting. Settled by German immigrants, the town is perched over the Potomac River about 12 miles past Harpers Ferry. It's home to Shepherd University, which creates an authentic vibe, blending old and new as students, shoppers, and families fill the main town thoroughfare of German Street. The singular white public library building won my vote for most architecturally interesting, occupying the 1800 Market House. We disappeared into Four Seasons Books and got lost for a while. Through German Street Marketplace Coffee and Candlery, I learned about ramps, wild onions native to West Virginia. The shop sells wild ramp jelly and aprons emblazoned with the message, "Let's go ramp hunting." More items will roll in for spring when ramps are in high season. With growling stomachs, we ducked in for an early dinner at Bavarian Brothers Brewing, relishing the lively atmosphere and Irwin's Angry Ale. I arrived hankering for a burger and didn't bother looking over the menu's details, so I was surprised to discover it was topped with a bratwurst slab, a nice German touch. Outdoors, I spied an expensive terrace, sure to be full on a nice day. Expansive terrace, I should say. It was probably expensive to build, but that's another story, right? Moving on. After another night at Hillbrook, this time in the Snuggery, a cozy place as the name implies, I bundled up after breakfast and walked to the spa for a facial with an esthetician, Angie Atkins. The small spa team stays busy serving the area overnight guests, Atkins says, and with the couple's massage being a favorite. So, if you're going to take a West Virginia weekend, and you'd like to consider that maybe, how about some tips? Well, here you go. Places to stay, there's the Hillbrook Inn and Spa at 4490 Summit Point Road in Charlestown, West Virginia. Online, check them out at hillbrookinn.com, hillbrookinn.com. This 1920s-era inn is a quiet, woodsy property with a winding stream. Filled with fireplaces, narrow stairways, and a cozy library, the four-star bed and breakfast is rich in ambiance. Guests can choose from 19 suites spread across the main house and four other structures. Rooms start at $149 per night. How about what to eat? Well, there's the Hillbrook Inn Restaurant at 4490 Summit Point Road, Charlestown. Check it out online at bit.ly/Hillbrook-N-restaurant. That's bit.ly/Hillbrook-N-restaurant. The restaurant at Hillbrook Inn offers fine dining in memorable surroundings under the leadership of Chef John Von Holt. Now, dinner served Monday and Tuesday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Wednesday through Sunday from 5 to 8 p.m. Lunch Thursday to Sunday is 11:30 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. A four-course dinner tasting menu, $95 per person. Five courses is $115 per person, and six courses, $135 per person. A la carte entrees start at $39. Then we have the Sumitra Thai Kitchen and Bar at 213 West Washington Street in Charlestown. And you can check this one out online at SumitraThaiWV.com. SumitraThaiWV, SumitraThaiWV.com. For fresh and flavorful Thai food, visit this little restaurant in the heart of Charlestown. It's open Tuesday through Friday, 11 a.m. to 2:30 p.m. and 4 to 8:30 p.m. and Saturday, noon to 9 p.m. Closed Sunday and Monday. Entree start at $14. And then we have Kelly Farm Kitchen at 1112 Washington Street in Bolivar, West Virginia. Online, KellyFarmKitchen.com. Get you more information. That's KellyFarmKitchen.com. This vegan restaurant is said to be the first of its kind in West Virginia. It occupies a picturesque house with a welcoming front porch. Open Monday to noon, 4 p.m. with a limited menu. Thursday and Friday, Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. And I should have said Monday was noon to 4 p.m. I misread that. But anyway, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. and 5 to 8 p.m. Sunday, it's noon to 5. Also closed Wednesday and Thursday, and the entrees there start at $12.99. Well, if you'd like to consider that weekend trip to West Virginia, please, by all means, do so. We hope that gives you some information to consider. And now, from a weekend visit to West Virginia, let's head west to learn how they're keeping the wild wild at 150-year-old Yellowstone National Park. Now, this article is written by Marlee Cass Myers of the Tribune News Service, and appeared in the April 24, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. After a surfer snowboarder based in San Diego, the idea of traveling to the American West come winter never crossed my mind. In fact, with the first flutter of a snowflake, I habitually head to the hills for ski season, be it Mammoth, Big Bear, or an unfamiliar mountain far from home. Setting fresh tracks with hiking boots rather than a snowboard seemed a waste of precious powder. Until, of course, I had a couch affair with Yellowstone. The Netflix original series visually took me to the outer range of Montana, where cowboys are branded as the cattle they drive and the horses they break. In all my years, never had a Hollywood product inspired me to pivot my winter plans for an unknown destination. But somehow, Yellowstone succeeded. I became one of the Dutton family ranch, turning the fictitious drama into a biopic in my mind, longing to visit this agrarian West where locals fought to keep the wild wild. And thus the trip planning began. It started with dropping pins onto Google Maps, followed by research on flights, lodging, availability, and the best time to avoid the crowds, not to be confused with the best time to visit. More than 4 million people explore Yellowstone National Park annually, most of whom visit in summer. I wanted to experience Yellowstone in its purest, most perfect form, so winter it was, with husband in tow, because frankly, the man helps me see the world in color. To further thin out human contact, we chose to travel midweek. Rumor had it that December through early March was the best time to witness fire and ice. That's when geysers, hot springs, mud pots, and steam vents turn into geothermal thespians during freezing temperatures. Naturally, the Netflix version had me longing to see a wolf in a snowy meadow, maybe even stalking an elk or two. If that was on the cards for this journey, I'd consider it a successful trip. Until then, we'd have to settle for just the elk, unstalked, of course, as well as deer and hawks that greeted us as we entered the corridor near Paradise Valley. Marking the north gateway was the Roosevelt Arch, dating to 1903. Inscribed in the cornerstone was "For the benefit and enjoyment of the people." Exactly 150 years after Yellowstone was founded in 1872, those words still rang true. even before it was named the world's first national park. Yellowstone's 2.2 million acres served as a refuge for Native Americans who foraged its lands and waters. As history goes, decades of tragedy bruised the park with overhunting, devastating fires, and introduction of non-native species. Lessons from the past have helped rebuild the park's ecosystem through conservation efforts and preservation of its heritage, making Yellowstone the healthiest it has been in over a century. The landscape doesn't lie. We saw it for ourselves, the awe-inspiring wonderland flanked by rivers, lakes, waterfalls, canyons, and more than a half of the world's hydrothermal features. To access these majestic canvases, we planned to overnight at Mammoth Hot Springs Hotel. That's when the real adventure began. In winter, only two of Yellowstone's nine hotels are open, and roads, other than Highway 212, can only be accessed by snowmobile or snowcoach. We chose the latter. Built in 1936, Mammoth Hot Springs Hotel recently underwent a major renovation, yet has retained historic integrity in spaces, including the map room. Here we sipped on huckleberry margaritas and watched elk gaze outside our window. We dined on locally sourced entrees like bison tenderloin and Parmesan-crusted trout. By 8 a.m., we were out on our first wildlife tour through Lamar Valley. It didn't take long before a herd of bison crossed our path, swaying like elephants with thick fur coats curled on the edges like a perm. These mighty beasts blocked the road, poised and confident, as if their winter endurance granted them license to dominate humanity. Naturally so, at 2,000 pounds and surrounded by 5,000 other bison park friends, we watched in silence, jaws to the ground, as these glorious brutes nearly shook the earth they walked on, from their nostrils bitter plumes of smoke dissipating by the time it reached their horns. Before noon, we had spotted a bald eagle, a moose, bighorn sheep, and a pack of coyotes devouring a kill. Unlike the mangy coyotes roaming our San Diego property, these coyotes were wilding magnificent. Their coats full and their faces fierce, to the point I asked our guide, "Are you sure that's not a wolf?" If only it were. Spotting a wolf in Yellowstone is a rarity unless, as our guide explained, you happen to be on the tour the previous day. Apparently an entire pack of wolves had been taken down, a bison, bringing National Geographic to life before the group's urban eyes. But I wouldn't give up. I was determined to dance with wolves before our trip was over, or better yet, have a three-dog day. Those who witness a fox, coyote, and wolf are considered Yellowstone lottery winners. I was ready to gamble. Binoculars pointed toward the horizon on the hunt for nature. We trailed a creek lined with boulders, each one capped in virgin snow like mushroom tops waiting to be harvested. En route, we ate box lunches before climbing into our vessel for the remainder of our trip. A snow coach. This monster truck, meets school bus, had massive tires that tackled the park like a champ. Beyond Canary Springs, we climbed to 7,000 feet, leaving behind aspens, lodgepole pines, blue spruce, cottonwoods, and junipers. Awakening us near Swan Lake Flats was a pristine view of Electric Peak, peppered with a flock of trumpeter swans within frame. Our ultimate destination was Old Faithful, some 50 miles from Mammoth Hot Springs Hotel. The journey was interrupted by commercial breaks brought to us by fountain paint pots bubbling in Lower Gyson Basin and Roaring Mountain billowing with sulfide gas. Along Fountain Paint Pot Trail, one can experience all four thermal features, including mud pots, geysers, hot pools, and fumaroles. The sound of hissing steam pushed through narrow vents in the earth, proving that Yellowstone was very much alive. We trailed Gibbon River to Burrow Spring, where boiling water shimmered like gemstones. At one point, walls of steam met curtains of clouds, giving the impression that Yellowstone was on fire. Nearing our second hotel, Old Faithful Snow Lodge, we caught a glimpse of its sleeping namesake. This highly predictable geothermal feature erupts every 2 hours, making it one of only six geysers that park rangers can predict. Until showtime, we would settle into Snow Lodge, a cozy log cabin-style hotel with fireplaces, a skating rink, and a ski shop for those who want to cross-country ski right outside the door. Late to bed, early to rise, we were ready to walk off last night's dinner of bison, short ribs, and wild game bolognese. And walk we did. Straight to Geyser Basin, where the boardwalks weave around 150 hydrothermal wonders, reminiscent of sea anemones and Caribbean waters and bubbling pots of rust. The visual diversity was staggering. It all culminated in Old Faithful's viewing area, as if waiting for a theatrical performance to begin. I noticed that we were the only ones there to witness the spectacle. This contrasted with the photos I had seen online, where hordes of tourists held cameras overhead to avoid obstruction. Now we had the place to ourselves, waiting silently with great anticipation, as if Old Faithful was a celebrity ready to make her Oscar debut. And then, from her mouth, no wider than a wrist, spewed a plume of smoke, followed by hissing, and then eventually a burst of steam and water shooting 150 feet into the sky. It was magnificent. That afternoon, we strapped into our cross-country skis and glided 5 miles along Lone Star Geyser Ski Trail. The groomed route traced Firehole River to Lone Star Geyser, known to erupt roughly every 3 hours. The pace, albeit slow in comparison to snowboarding, was unexpectedly therapeutic, forcing me to absorb creation one breath at a time. During our drive back to the hotel, frosty bison crossed our path, leaving trails of diamond dust drifting in the air, and a duvet of snow a red fox plonked onto a small prey, aiming to pin and catch a rodent along Nez Perce Crease. After a deep sleep, we coordinated our final day to highlight the Grand Canyon of Yellowstone. Having hiked rim to rim of the glorious Grand Canyon in Arizona, I wasn't expecting much, but then Yellowstone slapped me in the face with reality. Spanning 20 miles long, the cotton candy-colored canyon is 4,000 feet wide and 1,200 feet deep. Plunging waterfalls formed sheets of ice and frozen cones like stalactites in a mineral-stained cave. On the banks of upper falls were paw tracks left by river otters, overshadowed only by marshmallow-like caps along lower falls. This natural force of perfection was the final flirty wink from Yellowstone. 3 days prior, I entered the park longing to see a wolf. Instead, I left with a reverence of 150 years of progress, not the type that involves mass development or sky cranes, but rather the type that prioritizes nature over people. As our guide explained, it's the errors of our past that have reshaped the visions of tomorrow. I love that Yellowstone gets this. So maybe I didn't see a pack of wolves, but without a doubt, I danced with them. What a great trip that was. Now, well, observing nature firsthand is always fun, of course, and North Carolina is seeing a spike in bear sightings. Gives us a hint about our next story. It's a good example of how nature can sometimes travel close to home. The article written by Corey Dean appeared in the May 1st, 2022 issue of the News and Observer. The North Carolina Wildlife Resources Commission, also NCWRC, says it's seeing a spike in black bear reports and sightings this spring and is offering advice for humans in the state to safely coexist with the animals. NCWRC said in an April 21st release that the increase in sightings comes as no surprise since the state's bear population has grown over the past 50 years and the residential footprint has grown. As humans move closer to bear habitats, NCWRC said, it creates increased opportunities for bears to approach their properties, especially when humans have food sources or leave food sources out. This information likely sounds familiar to some Triangle residents, especially those who work at Rex Hospital in Raleigh, where a young black bear spent a day up a tree last July. But there's good news even as black bear sightings increase. Black bears by nature are not aggressive animals, the NCWRC website reads. They peacefully coexist in close proximity to humans year-round throughout North Carolina. The presence of bears in these new areas should not be immediately viewed as a cause for alarm or fear. So as black bear sightings and encounters become increasingly common for North Carolina residents, how can you safely coexist with the animals? Well, there are some tips from the NCWRC to keep you and the bears safe. Where do black bears live in North Carolina? Well, black bears are found across approximately 60% of the total land area of North Carolina, according to the NCWRC. It says the state's bear populations are concentrated in the mountains and coastal plain regions, but the population is expanding into central North Carolina, making sightings increasingly common in all areas of North Carolina, especially in May, June, and July. That's when young bears are looking for a new home after being pushed away by the adult female as she begins breeding again. Bears prefer large expanses of uninhabited woodland or swampland with dense cover, NCWRC says. In the eastern parts of the state, lowland hardwoods, swamps, and pocosins provide good habitats for bears. Some bears, though, have adapted to living near developed and more urban areas of the state. Note, the black bear is the only bear species found in North Carolina or anywhere in the eastern United States, and this again according to the NCWRC. Why are black bear sightings becoming more common in North Carolina? Well, the NCWRC says black bears have been dispersing through central North Carolina for decades, but as more people have come to live in this part of the state, essentially encroaching on areas where bears have traditionally lived, there have been more opportunities created for bears to cross paths with humans, either at their homes or in more crowded areas. Encounters are especially likely where humans leave food or other attractive items out where bears might smell or see them. Bears have adapted to living near people, NCWRC says. Now it's up to us to adapt to living near bears. Tips for safely coexisting with black bears in North Carolina. NCWRC uses BearWise, a national educational program developed by bear biologists, to educate and inform the public about how to safely coexist with black bears. Black bears offer, or rather, BearWise offers six key tips to prevent potential conflicts and live responsibly with bears. Never feed or approach a bear. If you intentionally feed a bear, such as leaving food out for them, you're essentially encouraging bears to approach homes and people to look for more. Avoid leaving out food or anything that smells or tastes like food in an area where a bear might find it. If you do see a bear, either at your home or elsewhere, don't approach it. Bears will defend themselves if a person gets too close, so it's best for your safety and theirs to leave them alone. Secure food, garbage, and recycling. Don't reward bears with easily available food, garbage, or recycling. Store any bags of trash that you take out inside trash cans and inside a garage or other covered structure such as a shed, if possible. You can also use trash cans with a secure latching system or that are bear-resistant. When it's time for your scheduled trash collection, place your trash outside as late as possible in the morning of trash pickup, not the night before. Remove bird feeders when bears are active. Birdseed and other grains, hummingbird feeders, have gotten high calorie contents, and that makes them very attractive to bears. Removing feeders is the best way to avoid creating conflicts with bears, the NCWRC says. And never leave pet food outdoors. Feed your pets inside when possible. Clean and store your grills. That's also an attractive thing. And the final tip, alert neighbors to bear activity if you see a bear near the house or evidence of a bear nearby so everyone is aware. So some good information there about bears traveling to see us. Well, that brings us to the end of today's episode of Armchair Traveler. We hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.